for Thursday, March 22nd, 2018. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. This rainy week in San Francisco, we got a hot pod coming at you. I'm Norm, joined by Jeremy, and no Kishore this week. We got Zach Ratting back in the studio. How you doing, Zach?
Doing excellent. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming, Zach. Of course, a professional maker of things,
professional fill-in for
and
people who are absent.
You're getting there, and multi appearance on the podcast,
and webmaster of buildcoolstuff.com. Mm.
Webmaster. Nice.
Yes,
I like it. Where you help companies prototype and manufacture
all sorts of things,
all sorts of electronics and physical things, and we might be picking your brain about some of that stuff later.
Sure, let's do it.
But how are you guys doing?
Doing good. I can't complain about the rain. That's illegal.
I know, right?
In San Francisco?
We're in a drought. Like this we need every drop we can get.
Yeah, I thought you'd get your San Francisco card, your San Franciscan card, by complaining about the rain.
Oh, really?
And the driving conditions.
I was gonna say the traffic.
Yes, yeah, traffic in the rain, maybe.
That's by Seattle.
You guys do anything fun over the weekend?
I'm just looking forward to Game Developers Conference, man.
That is this week, GDC. In the Bay Area, there are, I think, a couple of different GDCs. There's one in Austin, and they have some international ones, but this is kind of like the big
one. The mothership.
Yes, yes. Game Developer Conference, we'll be heading there immediately after recording the podcast, and hopefully checking out some cool stuff.
Yeah.
Any projects or anything you could talk about that you've been working on lately, Zach?
Ooh, let's see, a couple things. Not really personally, it's for my business, but... been retrofitting a pick and place machine, which is a machine used for putting parts on a printed circuit board. So the typical way that you build a circuit board is for like a hobbyist, or you know, when you build one of something, you take them out of the package and you put them on manually, maybe under a microscope if they're really small, and then you solder them together. And there's other ways. I mean, sometimes people use solder paste and then put them in a toaster oven and, you know, mm-hmm. solder everything together. But once you start making either a number of boards, or if the boards get complex enough, people typically use, or at least companies typically use, a robot of some kind to
on an assembly line.
And I discovered, the whole world of auctions and companies that go out of business that have this equipment for pennies on the dollar. And wow. Found a pick and place machine on auction for a very reasonable price, and drove up to Portland a couple weeks ago to pick it up. It's a 1,000-pound beast of a machine.
Describe how the physical.
Well, I mean, there's different size. Like, so there's machines much like 3D printers or even milling machines. There's desktop versions. There's also big industrial versions. And again, like milling machines, the bigger they are, kind of the more robust they are, the faster they can move. There's a lot more, precision that you get with kind of mass. So anytime something is moving and pushing either, let's say, a milling tool through a piece of metal, or in this case, a head that moves really quickly to pick up something very small, but because it moves so quick, you need to have the mass so the whole thing doesn't shake itself apart.
You don't want any backlash.
No backlash. Much like machine tools, if you look at some of the older tools that have kind of bigger, beefier, hunks of metal, they're kind of better in a lot of reasons. Though the machine that I bought was built in, I think the late 1990s, and it originally ran with a DOS computer. So
wow.
I took that kind of out of the system and put in a new modern computer, and ran some open source software, and now I have a modern pick and place machine in my shop.
How many axes does it move along?
The big axes, there's three, but then there's actually a number of smaller axes. There's a rotation on the tip to rotate parts, and then I've got a bunch of pneumatic things that kind of actuate as well for for moving tips, the things that actually pick up each of the parts. And then there's 64 feeders, so they can actually feed in each individual part. So all of those have motors. So
and it grabs the part using air pressure, right?
Yeah, it actually has a little vacuum pump and picks up these little, really, really almost microscopic parts.
So it can pick up really, really tiny parts. And what's the precision, like one centimeter by centimeter?
Oh, no. Precision is like in the, tenths or hundredths of a millimeter.
Oh my goodness.
So, instance, like the smallest part on most modern, cell phones, and they use something called an 0201, and that's the size of the component. And this machine...
In millimeters, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it's 2 millimeters by 1 millimeter. Like it's really, really tiny.
Oh my God. So your assembly line, the other part, your bed has to be as precise as well.
Oh, everything does. Everything right? does. So
you want to have that, everything has to be calibrated for each other.
Exactly. So it's a lot of fiddling, again, moving this kind of equipment, it comes out of alignment. And so there's been just a bunch of kind of adjustment. And because I sort of took its brains, I did a Frankenstein sort of brain transplant. There's a lot of kind of, figuring things out and getting it all, working, but it's been a lot of fun and I've actually been producing boards.
That's super cool.
It used to be where you could get any of the components for circuit boards in through-hole, versions. So if you wanted the big one that you just needed a soldering iron to adhere to the circuit board, you could do that if you were making one board.
Yeah, but not anymore.
Everything's now surface mount. So more and more, you have to buy the tiny version.
And it's even getting smaller. Like even surface mount, there's kind of levels of surface mount. Yeah. So it's like, these, TSOP packages are kind of big, but then the QFNs, and then it just keeps getting shrunk down and down and down. And if you want the latest, greatest chips, you've got to be able to do a really small surface mount.
How do you code a sequence into the machine? Is it just like CAM or it's like a list of steps?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot like doing a machine cut or, like a laser cutter, things like that. It's the same kind of process of, you have, software that designs the board, then you send it to this machine. And it's kind of the beauty, instead of doing it by hand, it takes out a lot of the guesswork where, sometimes you stuff the wrong part in the wrong slot. Well, the machine doesn't do that. So it's really helpful.
That's really cool. Simone has a KUKA arm.
Oh, yeah.
And a small one, I guess you can call it a desktop one. And one of the coolest features I've seen on hers is that you can manually position the arm and kind of puppet its motions and record a sequence and then press a button. And then it, using all its torque, will just replay that sequence and got to get out of its way. And just it can look very organic that way.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's... Robots are cool.
Robots are cool. Understatement. And actually, that's if you're wondering where Kishore is this week, he is hanging out with some robots down in Palm Springs at the Mars conference. You might have seen some photos being tweeted from that event. And I think he might have had chance to check out some Boston Dynamics robots, which has been super cool. Very, very envious of that. But let's jump to our top story of this week. Now, we are not a political podcast, so we won't dive too much into the political implications of this, but we got to talk about Facebook and the purported breach of data by this firm, Cambridge Analytica. Have you guys read about this? You guys know kind of what happened?
Mm-hmm. So, a lot to talk about.
The gist of it is that Facebook has its series of APIs and apps, and anyone can develop an app, like a game, for example, or survey that you as a user of Facebook may have filled out or may have allowed access to. Many times when you click from a website and you they want to grant your Facebook, whether you use your Facebook as a login for a website or to as a way to access the app, you have this pop-up page that says, do you want to grant this app specific permissions to your Facebook?
Terms and services.
And most people, I think, click OK because they want to get to that destination, that app, or enter some type of contest or something, right? But if you don't read the fine print, more often than not, it's not just your name or your email address that they want access to. Sometimes they want access to your friends' information. And that's exactly what happened here. There was a survey that Cambridge Analytica set up that reached 270,000 people, and those 270,000 people, total willing participants, filled out the survey, clicked OK in the terms of service, and allowed access to their friends, which then reached about 50 million people, those people who were not notified in any way.
This was years ago, right?
Yes. A couple years ago, leading up to the 2016 election. So the big question is this considered a breach or a hack of Facebook data, or is it an exploitation of their practices, or are their policies not sufficient enough to protect their users?
I thought there was more to that. I thought that they, this was like in 2015, that they had scraped a lot of data. They had gotten data on 50 million users that Facebook in turn asked them to delete.
Yes. The Facebook did ask them to delete it, but how, whether or not they verified the deletion.
Apparently they never verified the deletion. And what does it mean to delete data after you've used it?
And right. How do you verify getting rid of something? I mean, like that. <Right.
laughs> show me all your USB sticks.
Scout's right. Honor. I made the promise, right? Yeah. I deleted all the data. Yeah.
So why did Facebook ask them to delete it if they acquired it through a legal SDK?
Because
API.
The API that they had used was under the pretense of academic research. Mm-hmm. And they actually used it for
political purposes,
a private firm.
Interesting.
Commercial purposes, which is a violation of Facebook's business-to-business TOS.
Right.
But is data data? Like, I think that's maybe the core issue is, you know, whether you use that data for good or bad, is collecting the data by itself, you know, is that good or bad?
Yeah, and the people who, Cambridge Analytica would argue, how do you define good and bad?
Right.
Everyone thinks that the good guy.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And Facebook wants to say they're agnostic about all this. They're just, you know, people volunteer their information. They're just the platform. People are... Oh, they should know, you know, what they're putting on to these platforms. But most people don't know. They don't know that by clicking likes, they can be targeted by an average of 60 likes or so. They can know your gender, race, political affiliation, and all sorts of things about you. And this is not explicit, and right. That you're not made aware of this as a user.
But I don't know that it's any different than, say, you know, Gmail that would do targeted advertising, you know, for years. I mean, that's how Gmail started, where it's like, oh yeah, you're going to get advertising and we're going to collect this data. What is that data used for? Well, we don't
totally
really know.
I mean, and it's not to say Google is free from this either. Google has, they said, you know, we will scrape your emails.
Right.
But we don't know who's looking at that and how that information is being aggregated or abstracted in any way.
And for years, you know, credit card companies and stores that you shop at, I mean, all this data is out there. I think it's sort of, once it becomes politicized, then it gets a little bit of a spotlight on it. But I don't think this is anything new. I think companies have been collecting data about their users for years and years and years.
Do you guys think this is a problem that is only happening because of, we have this transition from people who are using these technologies who didn't grow up with them, that, you know, this is an argument and this is a concern that may be moot 15 years, 20 years from now, when we're one generation down the line, where both the adults and the children grew up with Facebook, as opposed to, and are more maybe cognizant of these concerns?
I don't think anybody is any more cognizant about the terms of service. You know, I think they just ignore it. I mean, it's sort of like, okay, I just have to click that okay box when I install a piece of software or I install an app or whatever. I think what's happened is, you know, we're okay with a certain level of kind of not knowing, and as a culture, as a society. And I think that's going to maybe change. I think we're going to have, you know, bigger, bolder text and be more explicit about what this data is going to be used for. I mean, that's where, you know, laws come into play and say, okay, this has to be regulated some amount.
Are you suggesting that in the future people will be more comfortable or just used to Big Brother, or that people will be more cognizant of the boundaries and the TOSs and what they're accepting?
I'm hopefully the latter, where the kids today are maybe more savvy about it, and that it's, you know, we're maybe probably still going to be ignorant of a lot of what's happening. But, you know, right now there is a divide between how everyone uses Facebook, but there's a divide between how people use it in the younger generations and
right.
those, you know, our parents.
But when you install Windows, I mean, and you get this, you know, 10 page or whatever page, you know, TOS pop up, what are you like, I'm not going to install Windows?
Yeah,
like,
if I need
an app or if I need a application, it's like, no, I'm not going to say no.
So there goes, that's where regulation comes in, and they can look at what the limits of those terms can be.
Sure. And maybe there's, you know, a more granular yes or no. Maybe, you know, much like there's kind of an opt-in for, you know, email marketing or things like that, where you actually have to say, okay, I'm okay with this amount of data being released, but not, you know, not any more than that. Or I don't know. I mean, it's a challenging problem.
Has anyone tried to delete their Facebook account?
You know, I don't use Facebook. I have a Facebook account because I treat it like the Yellow Pages for my friends from history. So if I ever need to look somebody up, that's where you do it. But that's it. So I've never wanted to delete it because there's really no data in there that is. I don't have a wall.
Are you sure about that?
What?
Because if you're someone like I know, for example, Will doesn't actively use Facebook, mm-hmm. but he has it tied where when he tweets something, the tweet gets propagated on Facebook as well.
No, I don't do that.
Oh, you don't do that either. No. But like, even if you do that, like, even if you don't actively use it, if you use it as a passive way, that data is still getting in there somehow. You know, when people tag you, for example,
right. like
your friends and family.
That happens.
Like they're getting passive information from you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I haven't. Have you deleted, tried to delete?
I have not. I'm afraid to try.
Why?
FUD.
Because I think it'll be very difficult, and I don't know if I can come back from it. And I think they make it difficult to really wipe information from it. I think they make it easy for you to, quote-unquote, deactivate an account,
right.
But the data is still there, and then you can come back. But
much like Facebook, you know, trying to verify that somebody's deleted other data, you know, how do you even know if you delete the account that your data's
right,
gone?
Right,
you don't.
They have backups. I'm sure they have many, many, many backups of all their databases.
Well, if you don't want to delete your account and you still want to lock it down, Shannon Morse, Patrick Norton's co-host on Tech Thing, tweeted a really interesting, a great guide on how to do that. So if you want to lock down your Facebook account, look for Shannon Morse on Twitter and follow her guide she posted yesterday.
I mean, the thing you should absolutely do is check how many apps have tapped into your account. Because if you played that one game 3 years ago and you clicked OK and you never play that game ever again after that day, those people, the publisher, the company who runs that game, may still have access right now to all the new things you've done to your account and all the people you've added and all their information since then. And people may be surprised how many apps they have accessing their data. And that's not Facebook. That's just someone running a Facebook app.
Right.
Who may be even less accountable and can just, you know, they can turn, you know, go bankrupt and still have that data and run away with it.
So I understand Cambridge Analytica was also involved with the Brexit movement and that they were hired in order to basically perform the same services, which is use big data and social media in order to have whatever influence those combinations can make. And so do you guys think that this actually had an effect on, for instance, the Trump-Clinton election?
I think it's impossible to tell.
Is it?
I think it's impossible to prove a direct correlation. Or direct causation.
Yeah.
Well, I mean...
And what that effect is relative to all the other things that were happening and the effects those things may have had.
Sure. I mean, but you can also kind of value it if you think about just marketing in general. I mean, how much money do companies spend on advertisement? And, you know, they can't directly measure how much effect that, you know, a Pepsi ad has on the Super Bowl. But, you know, clearly it must have some effect because they spend a lot of money doing it. They wouldn't just do it for fun. You know, I think all of the eyeballs that you have on a piece of information that you put out there, you know, repeated times, I think it definitely has some effect. I mean, that's kind of the nature of marketing.
Yeah, it's interesting. We feel like we have free will, but we are yet so easily influenced.
Absolutely.
All right, let's talk about some pop culture.
Speaking of being influenced.
Yes. one of the easiest ways you get influenced is by movie trailers. And we had one of the biggest movie trailers of the year and drop this past
weekend. In more than one way, right? Because this is a complicated trailer, as is the poster.
Oh, yeah.
There's a
yeah.
lot going on.
We're, of course, talking about Avengers Infinity War, the third Avengers film, and the beginning of the culmination. I'm saying the beginning because there are two parts of this film. The beginning of the culmination of 10 years of Marvel movies. This is technically, I guess, the first full-length trailer after they had the teaser, and it came with the announcement that the tickets went on sale for the movie coming out April 27th. Do you guys watch the trailer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, some people are trailer-averse, so I'm wondering, should we talk about this without spoiling plot details or just jump right into it?
I feel like trailers are free game.
Trailers are fair?
Yeah.
Ooh, that,
don't you think so? So few people are trailer-averse.
Oh, I know some purists.
Yeah,
we work with some purists. For the next 5 minutes or so, we're going to talk about Avengers Infinity War, and you can skip 5 minutes ahead. Oh, we're going to turn on the spoiler light. Uh-oh. Oh, Jeremy.
Why'd that happen?
I don't know. green. Okay. Green light means spoilers are happening. All right. So a lot happens in this trailer. There are so many characters. You can look at the movie poster, for which there are, I didn't count them. Is it like a dozen, 15 different characters or so?
It's too much. It's everybody but Hawkeye.
And Sam Jackson.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Is he still alive in the fiction?
Yes.
Okay.
He was the end of Avengers 2, I believe, or end of Civil War. One of those.
That's right, in the post-credits sequence. Is that what you mean?
Oh, yeah, he did have a post-credits sequence. Yeah. Oh, my, they have so many movies. This is all the different characters, and I bet there'll be some surprises as well that will set the way, pave the path for the next, 10 movies, 10 years of movies.
Yeah. Because does this mark the end of their phase? Phase three.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We think people are going to die. It looks like people are going to die. So someone's got to start a Deadpool, no pun intended, for the characters. The contracts are up for Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans.
Both of them.
I think looks at the trailer, it looks like Thor could die. It looks like Captain America could die. And it looks like Iron Man could die.
Okay.
You're
supposed to think that. You're supposed to wonder.
Right.
Of course.
Okay. Right. What do you think? 2 out of 3?
Die?
Yeah.
Unless they're going to, is this the Empire, middle movie where, it ends on a sour note? They have to redeem it somehow. I don't think they're going to have that much depressing, action in a single movie. That's a lot of.
I think it has to end on a cliffhanger because there are two parts of this. And
I think you won't know who dies. I think that's really what it's going to boil down
no.
to.
No, I would hate that.
Wait a minute. It'll be questionable whether someone has died or
of
not.
Course. Oh. Of course, it's going to be a Superman.
Yeah,
it's
really. You think they're going to leave the cliffhanger at the end of the film? You don't think they're going to do a gut punch and just show the death? You think that would be too obvious?
I think
as a character coming back in the next film way.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's my guess, just looking at it.
Has there ever been a Marvel movie like that, with that kind of big cliffhanger?
Well, but there's never been a Marvel movie with 15, main characters.
as Marvel Studios says, the most ambitious crossover event ever in history.
Yeah.
What's that? Clearly, like having all these Marvel
having all
characters
these characters.
Together?
Clearly had never watched Space Jam. What do you guys think of Thanos? The character. I mean, this is a far-fetched character. I think that one of the biggest achievements that the Marvel films have done is they started off with Iron Man, being somewhat grounded in the real world, like an inventor, a maker, right. Someone who, an MIT grad who was a weapons manufacturer who, in a cave, put some rockets on some metal and...
It obeyed basic physics.
Basic, right?
Cheated a little, but yeah.
Totally, right? Like, I mean, yes, that's probably not going to be a pressure suit in as he's flying into space.
Right.
But the scenes in Iron Man where he's testing out his thrusters and just struggling to do something as basic as fly, that grounded the character in some type of reality as a superhero.
I recognize some of those processes. Like, oh yeah, like that, that kind of failure. That's a normal, build a real thing kind of experience.
Yeah, and he had pick and place machines. He had
robots,
right?
Exactly.
And now we're in the realm 10 years later where we're taking for granted that same character in that universe coexists with a giant purple man who's seeking out five crystals that will let him destroy half the beings in the universe.
Well, I think once they introduced Thor, like that was the door that opened to the magic realm.
And they explained that. They said Thor was, magic is merely just technology that you don't understand, right? So this is all in some ways
Right.
Technology.
Right.
High technology.
But then that just, you know, I mean, I don't want to say it's lazy, but it just kind of makes it then anything is possible. There's no rules. I can, you know, I can fly backwards around the earth and, you know, reverse time. Like that's, and once you can do that, it's, you know, it's kind of like, okay, well, I can add anything.
Right.
So if somebody dies, well, maybe I just use the time, you know, stone and go backwards. You know, that it's.
Yeah.
Isn't Thanos always, he's always been there, right? Like he's part of the Captain America movies where he's in the shadow realm. And
he was in the first Avengers film.
Right.
That was the first Avengers film.
He's on the moon.
He's on his little island.
And he's got his underlings.
Yeah.
So he's always kind of been there.
It's been references. Little hints.
Yeah. But it's always been a more cosmic element to him. Like in the garden, he feels like he fits more in the Guardians of the Galaxy stories than he does in the Captain America stories. It makes all the conflict in those stories feel trivial.
Right.
Right? Like the corporate fighting that you see in Iron Man 2.
It's not universe ending.
Right. The stakes are much higher now. Yeah. So it's going to be a challenge on that film to have those stakes mean something. And they do that by having the stakes be the personal relationships between the characters. What does it mean for a kid in Brooklyn to have to face these universal threats, you know, in Spider-Man or a character, you know, Captain America, the character you've loved in all these films, to, you know, have him mimic, you know, when he's in the trailer, when he's grabbing Thanos's hand and resisting, having that be a callback to him fighting the bullies in, you know, the first Avenger in the alleyway in New York, right? Like these are things that are going to give it some emotional impact. So,
I didn't get that.
You didn't get that?
No, that's good.
Oh, yeah. And it's a big scene in the comics, too. He walks up to Thanos, and it's just a puny man, and Thanos smashes his shield, and he holds his gauntlet, and it impresses Thanos. Yeah.
Wow. So do you think someone will die?
I think Captain America's gone.
You think he's gone?
I think he's gone.
All right. I have a hard time telling him and Thor apart at this point because of their new haircuts.
They both got
beards.
They
need more distinctive haircuts.
Captain America's hair got longer and Thor's hair got shorter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, help a guy like me out. I don't read the comics.
And they're both Chris's in the real world. There you go. It's very confusing.
It's a lot. And, you know, to be honest with you, after seeing Black Panther, I care a lot less about everybody else.
Than Black Panther.
Yeah, I really like that movie a ton. And so I'm having a hard time. If he dies, I'll be very upset.
I don't think he'll die.
Anyone else is expendable as far as I'm concerned.
Wow. Wow.
All right.
Okay. I wonder what role Hulk's going to play. Because he's supposedly the most powerful being that we've seen in the Marvel Universe.
I think what he will...
What happens when he battles Thanos?
Well, that gives it a great way, just like in the last Thor movie, Hulk was in a world where he was not the strongest necessarily, and Thor stood toe-to-toe with him. Hulk is going to be there where, you know, Hulk being defeated easily will show the strength of Thanos.
Mm.
Okay. We'll see.
All right.
Yeah. April 27th. I got my tickets.
You agree the poster is too complicated,
I
right?
hate the poster.
Okay.
The poster gives me a headache.
Why is Spider-Man so prominent?
Because everyone loves Spider-Man.
All right.
Yeah. And, you know, contracts maybe? I don't know. They have good lawyers, good agents.
He's got to be happy about that.
Yeah. All right. Let's turn off our spoiler light.
Oh, Jeremy. Right.
Yeah. Turn off the spoiler light. Non-spoilers. Got some other pop culture, some movies coming out this week. It's ramping up. Did anyone see Tomb Raider?
No.
I saw the first one.
Oh,
like 2000? Like
five Tomb Raiders ago.
Yeah.
I saw that one. The Angelina Jolie
That's
one.
The one, yeah.
That's right. There's a new Tomb Raider movie out. I did okay at the box office. I think Black Panther still beat it. I didn't watch it, but reviews were, I think, tepid.
Yeah.
Do we really need that Tomb Raider? That film?
No.
Yeah. The last Assassin's Creed movie, wasn't a fan of that one either. Yeah. We'll see. And then Pacific Rim 2 is out this week. I'm actually pretty excited for this one. Reviews also have been not super great.
Monster robots battling.
Exactly. I mean, giant robot films. I can never get enough of those.
Big box of popcorn, and I'm all good.
Yeah. And I actually got to see this past week Annihilation. Now, this is an interesting film written, directed by Alex Garland, who was the writer for and directed his first movie was Ex Machina. So if you like Ex Machina, you may like this film. It's an adaptation on a book, a trilogy, Southern Reach trilogy, I believe, that came out a couple years ago. And it's about a team of scientists who wander into this mysterious zone.
The sparkly realm.
That's the shimmer.
The shimmer.
They call it.
It's a great cast, right?
And, Natalie Portman, Tessa Thompson, also from the Thor films, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and weird things happen in this zone.
Hmm.
Yeah. I don't want to spoil too much on that. It's
I was gonna say, spoiler lights are off.
It's a freaky film.
Really?
It is.
But would you recommend it?
Oh God. If you like films that have you thinking about them for days after and not sure how you feel about them, then
okay,
you may like this film.
I believe it succeeded. If that's the case, if I made a film like that, I'd be very happy.
Yeah, it's not a film that spoon feeds you information, and it all builds up to a finale. The last 30 minutes are the whole point of the film.
Wow! So don't leave early.
Don't leave early. Yeah, you may feel inclined, and it's kind of terrifying. It's a little bit of horror. The last one I watched that made me feel this way was Killing of a Sacred Deer. I don't know if you saw that. That's a
no.
Oh, it's also
it sounds very depressing. Weird.
Yeah, it is.
Super, I was going to say a real uplifting movie.
Super, super depressing films. Anyway, that's a recommendation for this week, and maybe we'll talk about some Pacific Rim 2 next week. On the video game pop culture front, we're not talking about this in tech.
We used to play video games.
I know.
When we had time.
There was a big thing that happened over the weekend. Twitch had its biggest live stream ever. With Fortnite, the streamer Ninja, Kishore sent me a message. Ninja's streaming with Twitch or with Drake right now. You're just saying words to me.
Yeah, I don't
know. Doesn't compute.
So Drake, the singer rapper, apparently plays Fortnite and was hooked up through his agency with the streamer Ninja, who he watches, and they played Fortnite together.
Why are we all... Do you know Ninja? Did you know Ninja?
I did not know who he was. I'm so old.
How does Kishore know who Ninja is?
Kishore watches live streams.
He's big into live streams.
Do you know this?
No.
Do you know Ninja?
No.
I don't know. So he's a big Twitcher.
He has 5 million YouTube followers.
Holy cow.
He has hundreds of millions of Twitch followers. He's doing this interview circuit now, which I think he doesn't say it himself, but the tagline is, you know, this guy makes $500,000 a month streaming video games.
Oh my God. My 11-year-old came home and told my wife, you know, there's a Twitch streamer who makes $500,000 a month.
That's the tagline. Yeah.
There you go.
That's him. Wow. There you go. Ninja. He has blue hair. He's a super, super nice guy. You know, he's a smart dude.
Are you saying I'm just a little bit of a nice guy?
Saying you're almost there.
Oh,
almost
right. There. With my green hair. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. All right.
It's just this thing. I think it's so funny that people find it really novel that celebrities, famous people, play video games. I think it's still such a novel thing because it feels so niche, even though it's completely not.
It's a great thing. I think because we need more of them to come out. You know,
but it doesn't.
When Robin Williams came out and talked on Letterman about all the FPS, you know,
right?
Games
he loves
that he
sniping
plays,
Call of Duty.
It was a great feeling. As
he
a gamer.
Named his daughter Zelda,
exactly. Like the more celebrities that come out and
it normalizes gameplay.
I think it's such a funny thing.
It is funny
because these games sell, you know, tens of millions of copies. When you're talking about the Call of Duties, right? And when you're talking about free to play games, like. When you're talking about a game like PUBG or Fortnite where you have millions of people playing, that's not a niche thing anymore. But why does gaming still feel niche? And why is it such a revelatory thing when a thing that feels niche, whether it's video games or cartoons or anime, like Serena Williams tweeted about, you know, watching Avatar: The Last Airbender, right? And why is it so novel?
It's because you
and
have
should
something,
it be?
Because it's something you have in common. It's a hobby you have in common with someone that you admire.
Well, I think for so many years, kind of geek and nerd culture was like, oh, it's this other thing. And people that were into it weren't the cool kids. And then when you see
one
of the...
And they were all boys.
And they were all boys. Yeah. And there was, I mean, there's a lot of kind of, you know, prejudice against that. Yeah. And, you know, we kind of grew up. I mean, well, I say we. I know I did. I grew up as a geek. And it's like, I always felt like, oh, yeah, I was kind of that, you know, lone kid playing Nintendo in his room. And, you know, to see it kind of more mainstream, it's like, oh, that feels good. That feels like, oh, yeah, that, you know, I'm not the, you know,
is it feel
recluse.
Like a thing where like, you feel like these people should have better things to do with their time?
Well, a lot of celebrities...
I think it humanizes them.
They do have better things to do with their time. And a lot of them, they're anti-technology. Like, they just don't need to be technologically savvy. But a lot of people play video games, and people just don't assume that of them. I think it's great. On the other hand... I was surprised that this was the biggest thing ever to have happened on Twitch.
We're talking about two massive fan bases.
I guess you're right.
You know, Drake's fan base, world-class celebrity, and you know,
but was it publicized, biggest, like advertised? Like,
I think
how
it
do
was
people
just
even
spread, it was
know?
Just spread on social media. when you know someone with millions of Twitter followers like Drake says, I'm playing with at Ninja right now on Switch, people or on Twitch, people were freaking out, and it became this whole conversation.
Yeah, I'm not that demographic, I guess.
I think it was a bigger surprise to me that Drake was like, I watch Ninja. Like,
yeah,
right.
Like playing video games, people who are famous or who are celebrities who play video games, no, I don't think that's surprising, right? But when they say like their media of choice, you know, like they not only play the games, they watch the streamers, the same streamers that we feel like are still a niche community, even though they have millions of followers. That felt like a more surprising thing to me.
Do you think this gives Will Smith a little hope that maybe there's a celebrity watching him?
Kishore's watching him every night.
Well,
you never know who's watching, I guess is the point.
No, that's true.
Yeah. When your own broadcaster.
I was going to say, we're talking to microphones in front of a camera, so
that's
you
right.
never know.
We rarely know. Yeah, we're always constantly surprised. I think, that was very novel. Let's talk about some technology news.
I thought we were going to talk about the mobile stuff.
I was going to segue into it, Jeremy.
Oh, well, okay, we'll forget that just happened.
Speaking of Fortnite and PUBG, these are games now you can not only play on your computer, but it was announced this past week that they have mobile components as well. And it's big news.
How did they both do this in a week of each other?
Well, they both did differently was the interesting thing. They're both, I mean, if you don't know what PUBG and Fortnite are, they're very similar games. Now, PUBG came out first and is probably the biggest hit in recent memory, your battle royale style game.
Oh, God.
100 players dropped into an island. Only one person survives, gets your winner, winner, chicken dinner. Hugely successful. And then Fortnite almost came out of nowhere. It was in development by Epic Games. And they were able to adapt some of their gameplay mechanics to adopt some of these free-for-all style mechanics while still retaining some of their more Minecrafting-like elements. Yeah,
but crucially, Fortnite is free-to-play.
And it's free-to-play. Right. And now Fortnite, that was the game that we talked about with Ninja and Drake playing, exploded on the scene. It's now had a huge fan base. So a lot of people are playing. I don't know what the exact distribution and who plays more, but they're both massive successes.
If I'm not mistaken, Fortnite has overtaken PUBG.
Oh, really? Yeah. Wow. Because of the free-to-play nature.
Yeah.
So that one is an actual Epic Games game, you know, the makers of Unreal, and also, more importantly, the Unreal
This is a David
engine.
And Goliath kind of
totally.
Situation.
Right. Although PUBG is now owned by Tencent, which is also its own Goliath.
So not quite
Goliath,
Epic.
Goliath. Tencent is the big one of the biggest publishers in
Are
China.
They? Oh, in China. In China. Okay,
yeah.
Well.
Yeah, they're a huge. They own part of Ubisoft now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, see. Learn something new. PUBG,
Goliath and Goliath.
PUBG also uses the Unreal Engine.
That's right. Exactly. So they're both Unreal Engine games. So Epic actually wins at the end of the day.
Right.
Right. So they make the Unreal Engine. And Fortnite, one of the things they announced 2 weeks ago was they were developing a Fortnite mobile. So Fortnite's on PC, it's on console. And the interesting thing about the mobile is that it's not a traditional port per se, where they took a different engine and ported the assets and scaled down the game. They made it almost the exact same game and have it off the same code base.
Right.
Because of the Unreal Engine. They actually released this as a mobile. It's only in, I think, an invite-only beta right now. But as a test to show that developers can use their engine and make one game across multiple platforms and have them be cross-platform compatible.
I mean, the claim to the on the engine is, you know, it's another checkbox. It's like, okay, I want to compile for PC, Mac, and mobile. So
yeah.
it's that is the hope, and they're kind of showing that it works.
The reality is you have to change some assets,
right?
Because you can't leave the complex geometry in there.
Right.
But they did that.
Depending on the processor, but right.
And you know, it's right now it's only the latest iOS devices, Android devices only. It's high system requirements for a mobile game. And also, you have to adapt the controls, of course, integrate touchscreen controls.
Now, I expected this to be a totally new interface, a totally new game style. Like, it would be a tap game, you know, like a timing game.
Yeah.
Or some...
Still FPS.
some weird riff on the game that is made to play when you're
so
on...
So, same branded IP.
Sitting in the bathroom.
But something optimized for the mobile... case.
Like the Super Mario game that was made.
Right.
The one touch.
But
jump
it's not. It's the exact
it's the
same
whole freaking game.
It's the whole game. Which is technically, I think, incredible, but I think it takes away from some of those design decisions that you get to make when you're building something for a platform specifically.
Right.
So I think it's a incredible technical exercise. I don't know how many people who love Fortnite are jumping on because they want to now play it on the bus, right? Or play it on the toilet as opposed to at their on their couches and at their desktops.
Dude, this is huge. It's the, first of all, right now on the charts, on the iOS charts, Fortnite is number one in the free game section and PUBG is number two.
Yeah, so that's the other announcement. So very shortly after Fortnite released their iOS version for beta, PUBG and Tencent, who owns PUBG, release their mobile version completely open to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the difference is the PUBG version is a more traditional port. There is no cross-platform play between the PUBG on mobile and the PUBG mm-hmm. on desktop. But my question is, does it matter?
As long as there's the player base?
As long as there's the player base. And if you're talking about the number two app download on iOS,
there's plenty of people to play with.
Plenty of people. And you actually probably get better competition because you know you're all playing on the same
right.
Device and you're all playing with the same interface as opposed to, you know, someone on a PC versus someone on a controller.
Yeah, I mean, just mouse look alone and a lot of these kind of technology, you know, even between sort of the Xbox and the PC, I could never do first person on a, you know, traditional controller. Like, I need my mouse look, I need my keyboard to be able to do all of the things.
Well, try a phone touchscreen.
I know, and that's why I'm kind of going like, really? This is a good experience? I haven't tried it. I'm really tempted to try.
I'm sure it's a better than nothing experience, and people who love this game love having it on the go.
But people are really raving about it.
People are raving about both versions. Like,
yeah.
they play surprisingly well. But I wonder if we're now at the point where you can have a mobile game that does play better with a gamepad and assume enough people will actually buy a peripheral.
Yeah.
You know, because you used to not be able to assume that. You have to design for the interface mm-hmm. that it ships with. Mm-hmm. But mobile's so big now, maybe you can design a game that clearly you need a gamepad to play.
Well, also if the game is popular enough where people are already playing it with the gamepad and comfortable with that interface on another platform,
right.
they want to be competitive and they're going to be compelled to. You know, you can just Bluetooth your PS4 and attach it to your mobile device.
Can you do PS4 gamepads to iOS?
I think
you need an MFI gamepad.
Oh, right. Yeah. So you need a SteelSeries one or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. I'm interested. It's something that I think we'll be chatting with people about at GDC. And it's I think it will be something
oh,
that
I'm
people
sure
will be talking
there's
about.
There's buzz about it.
Yeah.
This is my son plays this with most of his gamer friends at school.
Fortnite.
Almost exclusively. Occasionally, they'll go back to Overwatch. But
wow.
It's mainly Fortnite.
Is that going to take over Minecraft, you think? Because it has those Minecraftian elements.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's building bridges.
It's a different experience. I mean, there's not a whole lot of creativity in Fortnite. But the building is difficult. Like, I find that element to put me off a little bit. Like, I prefer, I don't really play either of these games, but if I had to play one, I like the more simplistic aspect of PUBG. The building stuff, you have to get good at that in order to win
right.
the rounds.
And people that are good are fast, and they're
building their structures for defense like immediately once they start.
So it's a more engaging action game as opposed to the thrilling survival game that PUBG is.
Exactly, yeah.
I like the latter, the survivalist aspect. And neither of these interest me that much because none of them are in VR.
Yet.
We sound like old people just like complaining
about
what these kids are doing these days.
These kids have no idea what's in store for them.
I know, it's
because
true.
It's all about the VR experience.
Maybe AR.
AR PUBG. Have a room like this and just crouch on the ground and look off in the distance during your lunch break.
Yeah. I love it. Can't wait.
The kids also have no appreciation for Toys R Us. And it's that lack of appreciation that has taken Toys R Us out of business.
Very sad.
That's not true. Kids like Toys R Us. They just
kids
don't.
Like the idea.
Their parents don't.
They don't want to spend the money.
They don't want to go there when they can order it on Amazon
or go to Target, which has the big box, you know, deals now. I don't know. When's the last time you guys went to a Toys R Us? Our closest Toys R Us
it's December because my daughter loves Toys R Us.
Oh,
like,
really?
She heard it was going out of business.
Oh,
she's please, Daddy.
Oh.
It's just not a modern experience. It felt like I was there maybe last year or a year and a half ago,
mm-hmm.
and it felt like something from the 80s and 90s. Like the lighting, the way it's merchandised, like everything just felt kind of old and antiquated. Like it's just a big empty warehouse full of stuff that's not really well organized. And
but that's the best, the exploration aspect, right? If you're buying toys on Amazon,
but I like
that.
I like the equivalent of a search. But I like the search engine. I want the aisle. Like, oh wait, I'm into you know, flying toys. Yeah. I want the 10 other flying toys on the same aisle, but it's like, oh, they're kind of scattered around, or they're done by, I think they're just organized differently, or they were organized differently, maybe by manufacturer instead of by item or something. It was just weird. It was just a weird experience, and it just felt old.
I mean, did you guys grow up in big cities?
San Diego.
Right, and like the Toys R Us experience here, I think, in like the Bay Area is very different than someone's Toys R Us experience in the Midwest,
maybe,
for example. Because there, those the big stores can sustain themselves, and it, you know, is a destination. You drive many miles to right. go to the big toy store. Here, it's on like Auto Row, right, next to car dealerships, and it's, you know, it's not the same thing. I'm curious what people's experiences were with Toys R Us growing up in like Middle America. When
wait, why is it different? What?
Because it's the things are like, I was in Indiana this past week,
yeah,
right, and like you had everything spread so much further apart. Mm-hmm. Going somewhere was a big deal, was like a destination, and I think one of the reasons Toys R Us went away was because the convenience of just buying toys was made easier when you had toys in Target.
Hmm.
And if parents are going to drive to one place, they're going to go to the Target where you get 5 aisles of toys,
and you can get your
and you can get everything else
and
your food and
your
everything
food.
Exactly, as opposed to going to the one big toy store.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Yeah, you're probably right, but I think it has more to do with online. Amazon's killing everybody.
Sure,
yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if Target one day has trouble, just like Circuit City did. But I will never allow anyone to disparage Toys R Us. Because for me, it was where I wanted to go.
Oh,
when,
yeah. Totally.
When I was a kid, that was, I could go to Disneyland and be happy, or I could just go to Toys R Us.
Spend 45 great. Minutes in Toys R Us and just walk down the aisle.
I mean, oh, yeah. It was just like, I was buzzing in there. And they used to get the software, and they have the games, like NES games. You get the ticket.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Like
you yeah, couldn't yeah.
Behind the counter.
Yeah.
Behind like the
bring it up
the
front.
Fenced off area.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, everything about that store was just like being in heaven when you're a kid. Everything.
Well, and you guys remember FAO Schwartz?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah.
That was heaven.
I guess, yeah, that was like the more expensive stuff.
Right, that was Fantasyland.
You never bought anything from
there. No,
that's why
no,
it closed,
no.
You know, 20 years ago. But that one had like, the one in San Francisco had like a giant Jack of the Beanstalk tree.
Yeah.
Like in the middle of the building, expanding like 4 or 5 stories.
Oh, yeah. Well, and even Toys R Us experimented with that. I remember going to the one in New York years ago, and it had, you know, big Lego sculptures, and it had a lot of these kind of bit more fanciful things, and it was an experience. And that was the kind of the modern version. But all the ones that I've been to, and like I said, the past couple of years, they've just felt cold and kind of bleak. And I think we're used to this different kind of experience when we go to, I mean, even if you go to a Target, they're just, things are merchandised differently, and it feels warmer and more inviting. And
well, what would a proper big box toy store look like? Has Apple figured out retail? I mean,
you wouldn't want the Apple experience.
Not
in a toy
for toys.
Store.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it is more the FAO Schwartz. I mean, that is the magic of it. I think that you'd almost need to have something like that.
To make it a play area?
To
as
make
well?
It, well, yeah, so you get more hands-on, because that's really the big difference. Like, they can't compete in selection with Amazon, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's no way that you can have as many products and the variety and even the price. So you need to have something else. And I think it's the, you know, can you touch it? Can you interact with it? Is it on display? Does it feel good? All of those things. Or have people around that are really excited about it? You know, all of those sorts of things. But, yeah, I don't know. It's a weird world where we're transitioning away from that, you know, destination to go buy a toy, because it's just not a
I also, you know, when you go to a Target these days, right, I'm using that as an example, it's the most recent, like, they have their toy aisles. Everything is so segmented. You have your Lego aisle.
Right.
You have your Marvel aisle, Marvel character. You have your Barbie aisle.
You have your boys' Lego aisle and your girls' Lego
right.
aisle.
But everything feels like, as an adult, you realize, oh, this is like, the shelf space is bought by these companies.
Yeah,
they
right.
make the deal with Target, and they have the shelf space. I couldn't find a single like DC action figure. Like Marvel, Disney /Marvel owns, and Lego own all the aisles at here. There are no like third-party offbeat toys, really. And as a parent, Jeremy, do your kids like that?
They don't think about that.
They just,
that's the point. Like,
wow.
They just think that's what's popular, you know, and to an extent it is, but maybe it's a feedback mechanism where it's popular because it's what's available.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at another analogy, like board game stores can, to some degree, they succeed today in spite of pricing being better and selection maybe even better on a site like Amazon.
Well, but do you get in the Midwest a board game store? Or is that niche just a market in the Bay Area where there's a bunch of geeks that are into board games?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, I don't know. I'd like to hear from people out there. Like, are there board game stores out in Iowa? Right? Probably not.
Not as many.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. We should do some market research. That's
what we're doing.
That's what we're doing. All right.
So there are 700 stores. Toys R Us stores are going to be shut down, and they are going to go through some liquidation sales. So if there is a Toys R Us near you.
Now we're excited that they're going out of business. Wow. We can go get cheap toys.
You should find out when they're going to start putting their products on sale, mm-hmm. and even some of their electronics. I think I saw some Nintendo Switches going for like well under $250.
Everything must go.
Everything has to go. Yeah, yeah. We should all take a trip there someday, like before they close. Just one last Toys R Us trip. Do you know? Bring $100. Buy as much as you can. I mean, you can get a lot.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right. Off to some not so great news. Did you guys hear about the Uber self-driving car crash?
Kind of waiting for the first one to happen.
Yeah, this is, I think, the first fatality involving an autonomous car.
In autonomous mode. Because, I mean, Tesla's had crashes where the driver died in autonomous mode. But this is the first sort of external person driving.
This was a pedestrian.
Yes. And
crossing the street, not at a crosswalk.
Right, with, you know, a bicycle with shopping bags abruptly walking into traffic.
Right.
And so the police say the car was likely not at fault. And this is a car with a person in it.
Right.
Doing testing.
This is kind of unofficial information. I haven't seen anything official yet, but I know they talked to the police department in Phoenix or Tempe, wherever it was. And they said, you know, unofficially, they're thinking that, yeah, nobody would have been able to stop or, you know, it wouldn't be the fault of the actual car itself.
A human would have had the same
absolutely
problem.
Yeah.
And the car was moving at 38 miles per hour.
In a 35.
That's
interesting. But even that's still in question because I saw another report saying, well, if you look at Google Maps, it's actually a 45-mile-an-hour zone.
Street view,
yeah. So all of these things. I mean, you know, lots of information that has to come out. I mean, and they have, I'm sure they have video of the whole thing. So they know exactly,
right.
what happened.
Right. And so the Uber cars, I understand it, use LiDAR-based systems, not mm-hmm. computer vision systems. And I guess it's up to their algorithm. Like, if these are scenarios that will happen at some point, whether it's someone walking in the middle of the street or coming out of the shadow somewhere at whatever speed, like, how fast can a car like this react? Uber, to its credit, has shut down its self-driving car operations for now.
And so has Toyota. Which I thought was really interesting. That's kind of almost the knee-jerk reaction to this. Now, not only in the U.S., not in other countries, but Toyota announced that they're also suspending testing of their chauffeur mode.
So what does that mean, though? Like, what are they waiting for? Like, waiting for the political fallout? Waiting for regulation? Waiting for... Because it's not like they're going to stop these completely.
They're waiting for the investigation to conclude, I bet.
And not put the car manufacturer or the system at fault? Or the public reaction, maybe.
It looks like it's going to go that direction. I read an interesting report that the real fault here is the state of Arizona, because they have more pedestrian casualties than any other state by far.
Right.
And it's because they have these super wide roads that favor the automobiles rather than pedestrians. You know, I imagine they don't do the thing they do in San Francisco now where the pedestrian walk light turns on before the green. You get the pedestrians going first, and then the cars are allowed to go.
Right.
They had like 10 fatalities in the past week.
So yeah, so it's when you start looking at the numbers of the actual accidents and fatalities, it makes the one fatality that's happened, you know, over the past few years of this testing kind of, it sort of puts it in perspective. I mean, we all have that like, oh my gosh, it's the first time a robot has, explicitly hurt a pedestrian or killed a pedestrian, but you compare it and it's like, oh, well, still the track record is really, really good.
Do you want, I mean, should the expectation be that the statistics are in line between self-driving and human driving, where if it's one accident per...
If we were okay with that, we'd all have autonomous cars already.
Yeah, but we aren't.
But we aren't. We treat that very differently.
Yeah. All right. Another piece of news we missed last week was the announcement of a new Raspberry Pi system.
It was on the list. Somehow we missed it. So there's a I would say it's not a huge deal, but it's been a couple years since we had the Raspberry Pi Model 3, Model B, and
it's a tick, not a talk.
Yeah, exactly. Every Pi Day, which it was on March 14th, they usually release a new Raspberry Pi, and this was the one this year. It's now the Raspberry Pi Model 3 B Plus.
Yeah,
it's been given a plus, so that it's slightly better grade.
Gigabit Ethernet with a little bit of a bottleneck.
But yeah, it's still run through a USB 2 bus,
right?
So you get maybe 300 megabits as opposed to a gigabit, but it's still faster.
Yeah,
it is faster. Yeah. It's got way faster Wi-Fi. It's got
better Bluetooth,
AC, and it's got they've increased the clock rate of the processor. It's the same processor. Yeah. They gave it a couple hundred megahertz bump. And they have enclosed this. I think the most interesting part is they've enclosed the Wi-Fi components
in a can
inside a little tin can.
FCC finally cracked down on their.
I don't think that's what it was.
It's for certification.
They did it on behalf of their users,
so that they could then get their devices certified, because then it's now a certified module.
Exactly. Right. So now the Raspberry Pi 3 is its own module. So if you're making a product based on it, you don't have to get the FCC intentional radiation certification.
Unintentional emissions.
Well, now that's all you need.
Right.
But if you did the Wi-Fi stuff, then you would. It's like 10 times the complexity.
Yeah. Yeah,
then you need to be an intentional, radiator, whatever it's called. And now that that's enclosed, you can just add that on because it's already been approved. So it's great for people making things based on the Raspberry Pi 3.
$35.
Same price.
Still same price, which is amazing.
That's great.
It's still so impressive.
Same price the Raspberry Pi has been almost forever.
Yeah. Do these new features open up your brains to new types of projects?
No. It's not that kind of product.
Yeah.
It's just slightly faster one.
Yeah.
I really use it. I use the Raspberry Pi 3 all the time for Octoprint, my 3D printers, and I'm not even sure this will make that much of a difference.
Mm.
But I think the extra Ethernet bandwidth will come in handy for the video streaming that employs.
Yeah. I use them a lot for controllers, just for random pieces of hardware, just because it's so cheap and just easy to be like, oh, look, there's a PC I can log into, and it's got Wi-Fi, and it's sort of ubiquitous. And even if I'm not really needing it, it's like, oh, I'll just leave it in there so that it's easy to access. It gives you an access point.
How's the hardware encode for video on that now? Is that any good?
For encoding?
Yeah, if you want transcoding.
I've actually never run transcoding on there.
It's probably not gonna be great.
I still
it doesn't have a real GPU. It doesn't have
exactly.
I mean, it's not the hardware for that.
Yeah, well, if you have gigabit Ethernet, you don't need to transcode.
You just stream it.
Yeah. Let's talk about some Apple news. One thing I want to talk about is this Siri report. This is a kind of a big deal. People who used to work on the Siri team are bickering with each other over social media about reports of what happened with Siri, development of Siri, and why it's not so great.
Oh, good. Explain yourselves.
Yeah. So the Information publication has a report about the big problem with Siri after Apple launched it with the iPhone 4S.
Okay.
And
it was a third-party product, right?
Which was still called Siri.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they bought the technology, bought the team.
It wasn't a voice-activated thing. It was like a text input, and it was just an interactive assistant that way.
And apparently there was some internal debate over the purpose of Siri, because this is, again, before Amazon Alexa, before Cortana, these voice-activated assistants became such a whole household item.
Ubiquitous.
And a lot of the conflict came down to how often Siri should be updated. iOS chief Scott Forstall, who left Apple after Steve Jobs passed and the succession.
He was in charge of iOS?
That's right. And he put the person in charge of Maps on the Siri team. And their thinking was that Siri should be updated once a year, like their other products.
Mm, like an automobile.
Or like iOS.
Yeah.
Now, was that after the whole Apple Maps debacle?
I'm not sure exactly on the timeline when that happened, but that led to the team not being able to deploy updates as frequently as they'd hoped to, or have a system of developing updates for that purpose. And that's one of the reasons why Siri apparently is lagging behind the other
And Jeremy,
competitors.
I've heard you just bag. I mean, you're an Apple guy through and through, except you just don't seem to have good luck with Siri. But I've had the exact opposite. I've had such good luck with Siri.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's just my voice or whatever it is. It's tuned for me. But, you know, ever since, you know, all of the hands-free driving, you know, kind of laws came into play, I've used Siri in the car, and it's worked just wonderfully. And it almost always recognizes me. Now, my wife, not so much. But for whatever reason, I haven't had those complaints.
The car stuff, I don't have an option. So I do the same thing. And I use CarPlay, and I use Siri to send text messages.
Yeah.
And it does pretty good at that. I've learned to enunciate for her.
Yes.
And it's a very specific use case because it's, you know, it's text messaging.
Right.
Whereas using Amazon Alexa, I'm sorry if we're activating devices, but if we use that, then it opens up quite a lot more that you can engage with, and you might be asking for directions, or you might ask for recipes or facts.
Well, I use it for putting remind, like, because a lot of times I'll be driving along and it's like, oh, I need to be reminded at 8 a.m. to go pick up something, or you know, put something on my calendar, or send a text message. And you know, it's
for specific phone functions like that. I agree, Siri's fine, but it's gotten to the point where it's less a matter of her understanding me and more a matter of functionality.
What it can and can't do, and part of it's because
it's not
unlike Alexa, there's no open API for people to add these tools and features. There is a Siri Kit, but it's, like, I think you can use some type of like Uber type service with it, and like booking rides, setting up to do lists. But there aren't a ton of things.
Whereas the Amazon Echo has SDK where you do what you want.
Yeah.
And anybody can make a skill.
Sure.
And there's some really, really intensely good stuff out there for
it. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
games,
yeah.
Games that
games
you can
are
play
really good.
With custom audio that can be played on cue. Different Alexa voices that can be
used.
We
still play Jeopardy in our house.
She can whisper. She can yell. She can do all these cool things. I mean, I tweeted this thing that you can do where if you have an Amazon Echo, you tell her, open the magic door. And my daughter and I have been playing that for 20 minutes a night for about a week and a half now. And
what does that do? Is it just voice? Is it like a choose your own adventure style story?
It's not choose your own adventure because there aren't multiple endings, but it is an ongoing interactive fiction where it is basically a choose your own adventure that just goes on and on. And you can choose all these very different paths, and there's all these custom sounds.
Purely voice-based,
but you hear Alexa voices that you had never heard before. Like, she can do other accents. And there's a lot going on in this. There's background audio playing while she's talking. There's a lot of technology that you didn't even know that she's capable of.
Because, obviously you have output. The speakers are decent if you have the full Alexa, not just the Dot. Now, they can't plan for everyone having that. But most of them also have the ring light on top. Now, that would be cool for them to tap into maybe the lighting on the device, or the lighting that it has control over. Maybe not temperature, but if it's going to tell a story and has like control
all
over
all of a sudden
your
heat
lighting,
turns on, and,
right? Like it's a very intense situation. But they can like turn off the lights or turn it back on or dim them. These are all storytelling abilities that you could have in some type of interaction.
So I mean, it's moving into AR. I mean that's it's kind of a it's a audio, it's a environmental in that sense.
Mixed reality.
Yeah, right. Or exactly. So, I mean, for me, that isn't what, and again, maybe it's just the use case, that isn't what my virtual assistant is there to do. And
it needs to have the core competencies of time, weather, to-do lists, directions.
Yeah, and it's also, what is it tied to? I mean, I haven't been able to, get directions with my Alexa, but I wouldn't because it's not with me all the time. So, I mean, that's the difference. I mean, at least in my world. So, I think, Hello Google and Siri, I think are just, because they're on a mobile device, it's just so much more useful in that sense.
But
from an entertainment view, you're right. I mean, I think Alexa has got to be.
And now that Apple has their speaker, it's different. But until then, they also didn't have the microphone array. So just the capability of it to recognize what you're saying and understand you and hear the activation word, it's been limited because the phone is not meant for that.
Right.
In the same way that an Echo is.
Yeah. And its functionality on the speaker is one of the weakest parts of the speaker, according to reviews of it. And even in this report, they talked about how the HomePod team had no idea about Siri integration until well after the Alexa came out. And then that's when they started to bootstrap that technology on there. And it doesn't feel that seamless. And I don't think people are very happy with Siri on HomePod. Yeah, it may sound great as a speaker, but if it can't play a bedtime story with your kids, then you're going to choose the other device.
Do you have an Echo?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just curious.
Yeah, we play Jeopardy on it. That's our entertainment.
Other Apple news. Bloomberg has a report about Apple working on some future-looking technologies. They spent more on R&D this year, many more times than in past years, and going forward, they have so much money. And one thing that they're investing in is apparently new displays. They have a new production facility, prototyping facility, near their headquarters in Palo Alto. Cupertino. And these are to develop micro LED displays. Have you guys ever heard of this? Micro LED?
Yes.
Define micro LED.
As opposed to OLED. This is a post-OLED technology.
Just a different manufacturing process, more like LCD, there's lots of different flavors. I mean, it's basically putting down micro electronics on a display in an array. And instead of using, OLED, organic LED, components, it's using more like this traditional materials, but just in a microscopic way so that you can do, brighter displays or faster updates or all of some of the limitations that OLED have, regular LEDs don't have.
So is this more in the controller for the panels or in the actual pixels?
I think it's the technology of the pixels themselves, actual light emitting material.
So the some of the benefits purportedly are brighter,
yep,
and more power efficient, and maybe faster refresh rates. But right now these are at small sizes. So
small like iPhone.
Small like maybe Apple Watch.
Ah,
yeah.
So
we're OLED to start with.
Right.
So
right.
I mean, that's just
you got to scale.
You got to scale
at some point. Right. It doesn't mean that Apple is going to be manufacturing any of its displays in the future, but this is the first time it's been reported that they've looked into developing their own actual display technology as opposed to relying on a supplier like Samsung or LG.
Which makes sense because they have the money to be their own supplier.
Yeah. Right.
And they've always wanted to make as much of the widget as possible.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't blame them.
Yeah, because right now the phone displays are sourced from different companies. You have quality control, of course, but... they are on the behest of Samsung and LG's R&D,
right.
And they don't want to do that. They want their competitive advantage, especially if it means that they can develop an Apple Watch that will run for days or weeks on end, right? They have the money. Let's jump through a couple other bits of news.
Just real quickly, I got I didn't get it for them. My kids got these. I think they're made by Fitbit. They're little wristwatches that do a very small amount of tracking. Where I think it's just an accelerometer that tracks steps,
mm-hmm.
but it runs on a coin cell battery and it lasts all year long.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, no, an accelerometer and BLE is you can run it forever.
Yeah, BLE. I mean, I couldn't believe it does this Bluetooth transfer to the iPad. And it has a screen with a light on it you can turn on.
Yeah.
I mean, that's power efficiency.
Yeah, well, it's all about duty cycle. So accelerometers really become super low power. So they just kind of wake up, especially they have some internal circuitry to only wake up when they're being, moved. And then, BLE, depending on the refresh rate, how often you transmit data, it can be, again, because it's really, really short bursts and relatively low power during those bursts. Yeah, you can have, it can last for a really long time. I mean, for years, they had like the chest straps for doing heart rate, and, those would last for years on a single coin cell. And it's actually really similar technology. So, I mean, I think if they sat there and lit it up, every 10 minutes, then obviously that's going to kill the battery.
Yeah.
But under just regular use.
I'm super impressed. And coin cells aren't jam-packed with power. I mean, if you do a LiPo or something like that, you could...
Yeah, but lithium primaries actually have... They can't source a lot of current, but over a long period of time, they actually have a decent amount of power. It's just... You have to just kind of sip at it. If you take too much, then it kills the life.
Wow. I think we take so much of our interaction with our devices for granted, right? We want to be looking at the displays and getting the updates. And sometimes it just needs to be doing its thing.
In
the background. Couple things. Last week we talked about how YouTube had some plans to put some Wikipedia data in the description of its videos to try to counteract some conspiratorial or fake news videos that are being propagated by its own algorithms. Apparently they didn't let Wikipedia know. And so Wikipedia is now super afraid that that's going to lead to people spamming Wikipedia with conspiracies. And altering pages and vandalizing pages.
To back up their own videos.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wait a minute. So So they're worried that people will see these entries on YouTube and then go and change them so that they will endorse the conspiracy theory.
So I assume that YouTube will just algorithmically pull the data, from Wikipedia based on whatever the licensing that Wikipedia has, right, which is pretty open. And Wikipedia is afraid that people will vandalize those pages based on traffic. They look at really popular YouTube videos and they want to change what people see as a authorized, validated source, and then not realize that's all user generated as well.
But for years, I mean, when your Google search results, the top one or two results have been Wikipedia for a lot of searches. I mean, I know just for years, sure, like that was like the default. When you're feeling lucky, you would go to Wikipedia. And
it's a real strong brand.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, people trust it. You know, college students certainly trust it when trying to plagiarize their papers.
I wonder if there's really any impact to be concerned about. I mean,
that's the question. Is it any different? That's what I'm saying. Is it any different than the Google results? You know,
Wikipedia, their biggest problem has to be vandalism, and they just have people who are hardcore users who are just looking at all the changes all the time, and you know, nullifying them and fixing them and going in. I mean, if you make a change to a Wikipedia entry that has any amount of traffic, you're not going to.
It's not going to happen. Yeah. And those are all real people too. So they have their internal politics of what constitutes a valid change and a useful change. Like, how come these descriptions on these sections are only this length? Do people want more? What does it mean to be an encyclopedia? What is
crowdsourced information?
I know it's like it's just like people can optimize search engine results. You can optimize facts, and it's not about it's
optimizing facts.
Cambridge Analytica over here.
It's not just about like, you know, whether something's truthful or not. It's about the way it's presented, the order in which it's presented,
absolutely,
and what's not being presented in contrast to it. All very fascinating. Some last final hits. Lytro, you guys ever use the Lytro?
I played with it once.
The little guy.
It's a weird rectangle camera sensor. Yeah, we actually have one. Adam dug it up and gave us one. The idea was that you could take a photo and then using their software, process the photo and change your
focal point
from the background or the foreground. And all that information would be gathered. They've pivoted since that camera. They had two cameras actually that didn't sell very well, and now they were making a light field camera system platform for filmmakers to map environments. There's a rumor that Google may be buying them.
They must want some of their patents. I mean, that's the only reason I can imagine, because they're not going after their product.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Because I think Google has some investment in virtual reality and augmented reality, and they need some type of content, and they're looking at ways, you know, like with the Google Jump camera, ways to document the world that you can then experience in new and novel ways. And
do they want depth sensing capability?
I think they want some type of light field capture technology.
Yeah, but is that in order to interpret a 3D space? Because what we really want from VR is the ability to grab our surroundings and then move within it.
Right, which that's, if you're going to do that, you need to build out the environment. There's now manual labor in building out that environment.
Well, unless you have a rig that can actually capture it.
Right.
Through LiDAR or some other sort of, again, there's a lot of the photogrammetry stuff that people are trying to do. But it's some of the challenges are that movement, right? Like I can rotate. It's like 3D video versus actual being in a simulated environment.
Yeah.
I can move around one of them. People have played with sort of multi-camera rigs that let you do, you know, some movement or within a sphere. But it's interesting. I feel like it's either an IP grab, like they just want a particular patent and Apple can just throw, Google can just throw money at it.
Right.
Or they're doing an acqui-hire kind of thing where they just want the people because they're smart, you know, optics and algorithm people.
I'm really curious what Google's play is, because we all want the environments you can capture and can walk around, and whether that's through photogrammetry or some type of modeling system, that's only going to be useful for someone who has a system that can, a virtual reality rig that allows you all that type of movement. You know, the daydream stuff right now
doesn't. Right?
And
it's not tracked.
The mass market type products, you know, outside of even with, you know, the Vive Focus and the Oculus, the Santa Cruz with 6 degrees of freedom, that stuff is still, we think, a little ways away and not for mass market yet. most of the mass market stuff is going to be 3 degrees of freedom. And I think maybe Google wants some type of capture technology that can give them more, better three degrees of freedom content than 360 video or 360 photos.
I think this is the last year you'll be able to say that. And I don't think that the Lytro, whatever the result of the acquisition is, I don't think we'll see that until next year at the earliest. And so this is just future thinking. It's all going 6 degrees of freedom.
You think this is the last year of 3DoF as a mainstream?
As soon as Oculus releases Santa Cruz, no one's going to be able to compete unless they are.
Depends on what price point. With AR looming in the distance, naturally 6DoF.
but with the AR kit from iPhone, they've basically proven that with camera technology and accelerator, gyro, IMU kind of stuff, it's like, okay, I can basically track in, do 6DoF tracking. I don't think there's any excuse for future hardware that has a decent amount of processing power on board not to do tracking. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. I mean, because the experience is so much worse.
But in terms of content, are people mostly going to want to be walking around even with a wireless headset in their living rooms?
They want to be able to tip their head. Yeah. They want just a little bit of motion.
Right. But mostly their bodies are going to probably be on couches and staying still.
That's fine. I'm not saying it needs to be room scale. That's up to the developers. I'm just saying in terms of the technology.
Right.
We're moving towards 6DoF.
And that type of experience where you're able to move a little bit laterally and still feel comfortable and get a little bit more information, but not necessarily have to wander in a space.
Sure.
That's the kind of content that Lightfield is going to be good for.
It could be.
And that's the technology that we were hoping the jump cameras would be good for in doing 360 videos with some type of parallax.
You mean all the GoPros?
Yes. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I was expecting that too. Their video made it look like they could do it
with some, and it's kind of what we want. We want like really high quality 360 experiences with parallax, so you can move within 2 foot by 2 foot area, and feel immersed.
Yeah,
someone will make it.
Yeah. One last bit of product news. I want to talk about some Logitech speakers. These I thought were interesting. Logitech has announced speakers that have lights on them, like the Philips Hue system.
Oh, and does it make it sound better?
Nope, doesn't make it sound better. But they're desktop speakers that can project light behind your computer and at your wall and can change the light based on what's on display on your monitor. And I thought this was a totally interesting novel concept. Mm-hmm. If games support it, for example, like one example we're talking about is maybe you're playing Need for Speed, like a racing game, and a cop chases after you, and the police lights turn on. Well, wouldn't it be cool if then you see flashing red and blue lights?
I do think that would be cool.
I
think it is a very specific use case where it's actually useful.
Yes.
I don't see that general purpose.
Yeah. And I think they have an API that game developers can tap into and code their games with certain actions to give you certain lights.
Nobody's going to do it.
That's the problem, right? The chicken egg problem. So they had to build in a system that would make it usable for some other, for daily purposes. And they've done two things. One is a audio visualizer. So if you're listening to Spotify, it will take the output because it's a USB sound card.
They've made a color organ,
And you get, you get colors that match with the bass drops, maybe.
Sure.
Right? Or the mood of the music, right? Or they have another system that samples your screen and can take an average of the color values on certain quadrants of your screen that you can determine.
Because there's four lights, and so you can do four quadrants.
Four quadrants. You drag and draw and have those change based on the content you're watching, if it's like a movie.
Okay. I mean, there are TVs that do that, or at least
the Philips Hue system,
aftermarket things you put behind your TV that basically project the average color on your wall.
So, I think there's certain types of movies that may benefit from this, certain types of directors and cinematographers and certain style of films. One thing that I don't know if they're going to do well enough, and I'm really is the latency, because scenes change very quickly.
Oh, but no, they actually don't. I mean, if you think about 30 frames a second, 90 frames a second, compared to data transmission and how fast you can blink an LED.
So the question of, are they sampling at 24 frames a second or at least that? And second, if they can change lights that quickly and what that transition feels like and whether that's going to be jarring from the user experience standpoint.
I wouldn't worry so much about latency because the data stream is so small. I mean, we're used to, we're talking about latency in like HDMI. Mm-hmm. Well, how many pixels are on an HDMI screen? You know, many million.
Yep.
Where we're talking about, you know, 10 pixels. So the actual data that's being transferred between the computer and the device is so small that there'll be, you know, not detectable latency. I don't think that's a problem. I think what's more the challenge, I mean, you're sucking up some CPU to be sampling video.
Yep.
Like that actually does put a draw on the system. And then it's just like, okay, how much light can you get from, you know, a single little source and like, exactly, you know, to shine up on a wall? I don't think it's going to be that compelling.
Yeah. For your desktops.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or from user experience, will the average make any sense? Like if you have a scene and the scene is really green, but the one area it's sampled is all is like white, then that's not going to match up. And so unless there's no way movies are going to be coded with this data.
Right.
There's no one's going to generate a script. It's not like subtitles where you can download an extra file and have timestamps and say for every scene, have this arrangement of RGB for these four lights. I'm curious. I'm really interested. I'm going to get one in to test.
Jeremy has thoughts, I can tell.
No, I just wonder if for games, I like the idea more than I ever did for movies. Yeah. So that's one thing going for it. I always thought with movies, it would just be distracting.
Yeah.
Because I want a black room. And I want the screen and
the focus. You want.
I respect that the director had those borders in mind, and I want to watch my rectangle.
Yeah,
but maybe with games, it's a little more immersing.
If you had other information, yes. I think like you know the example that you said as far as like you know police lights or something like that.
Yeah.
Like if it adds something, totally. Maybe the muzzle flash of a gun or you know some other you know blinky you know information that would normally be blinked at you. But it just seems really limited.
Well, both for games, both Microsoft and Razer experimented with systems, with projection-based systems, where you do projection mapping around your computer monitor, and your GPU would export additional resolution, additional video.
Are you willing to sacrifice GPU speed for doing that?
Well, if you have like a 1080p monitor and you have, then and you're not playing at 4K or something, right? And then you're buying an extra projector for your room that projects around you, around your monitor. And so you have to avoid the silhouette of your head and then gives you extra data for your peripheral for extra, quote unquote, immersion. These are all like things out of like weird tech demos or like, I don't know.
They look good on paper.
Yeah. And they look flashy at conventions.
Yeah.
But whether it's going to make sense for anyone to have any of these in their homes, I'm not sure.
It tells me speaker manufacturers have made them sound as good as they can.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Or, there's no upgrade path. Like,
or they know that. Going to get to the next step, it's going to be this much more, and so they're going to have to sell a different class of speaker, or they can't manufacture at that quality.
Exactly.
This is their tick, their not margins. Their talk.
Exactly. I mean, we've had speakers and headphones and speakers for forever now, and it always amazes me every year how speaker manufacturers and headphone manufacturers can have a new SKU. Right? What are they changing?
The logo on the outside.
The ID of the device. Or is there actual fundamental improvements in their manufacturing, even iterative improvements? Is this year's, does it sound that much better?
This is a Patrick Norton question.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Before we move on to our next segment, I want to thank the sponsor of this week's episode of the podcast, and that is Google's Cloud Platform. If you're looking to move to the cloud and don't know where to begin, check out Google Cloud Platform's weekly podcast, where Google developer advocates Melanie Warrick and Mark Mendel answer questions, get into the weeds, and talk to GCP teams, customers, and partners about best practices, from security to machine learning and more. Hear from technologists all around across Google about trends and cool things happening with their technology. Learn more and subscribe to the podcast at g.co/GCP podcast. Once again, that's g.co/GCP podcast.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
Great news, everybody.
Yes.
The HTC Vive is now only $499.
Hey, price drop.
Yep. That's all great
right.
news.
That is great news.
That's all the HTC news, right?
Nope. We got more HTC news. The Vive, big price drop, and I think that's great. I think it's still a good system. I think you still want to factor in maybe another $100 if you want the deluxe audio headset, which deluxe audio headset, which I think you would want. But they also have a new product on the horizon. And that new product is the HTC Vive Pro, which is available for pre-order now. And they announced a price, which is $800, $799 for the Vive Pro. And we're talking about just the headset.
No tracking.
No controllers, no beacons.
So you need two lighthouses, and you need the controllers.
That's right. Yeah.
This is purely for people that already have a Vive and they just want to upgrade their headset.
Yes, yeah. They want to upgrade the headset. They want increased resolution, maybe better comfort. Those stereo cameras on the front that we're not still exactly sure what they do.
Can you sell your old headset? Not really.
To somebody with other trackers.
Yeah. For someone who has a room set up that just needs another headset, I guess.
It's a weird.
Yeah.
Right, maybe Will Smith is looking for a headset. Right?
He's maybe the one person looking for a headset. This doesn't mean that they're not going to sell some type of Vive Pro package with controllers and with trackers in the future, but that's probably going to be a couple hundred dollars more.
Yeah.
So it might even make some sense if you have the money and you want to buy a Vive Pro today, to buy a Vive Pro and their newly discounted headset, the original Vive headset with controllers, and have two of them.
Then you don't need the Pro Audio strap.
There you go. High price.
Yeah, we actually got a nice demo of this maybe a month ago. Was it two months ago?
Yep.
And we liked it. But we thought a wise price point would be around the $500 mark.
Well, if you set the price this high, you can only go down. You can't go up. And if you set a price low, I mean, then your margins are going to be what they are. So they must have done the market research to know that in terms of maybe their business partners or companies using this in a professional capacity who have the money, they can sell enough headsets to those people. They've always said this is for professionals, not necessarily for the home user.
It's right in the name.
I mean, yeah, it says Pro, but it's weird that they wouldn't release their tracking and controllers with it.
I think
that's the weird thing, because then it's assuming that you already have a original Vive, and that's mostly consumers, not on the Pro side.
I think I would disagree. I mean, I don't know. You're right. Mostly in terms of
number of units sold.
Right. But there's going to be some people.
Oh sure.
Car designers, whatever. People working.
That's not
in
how
CAD.
They're marketing it. That they're marketing it as this is an upgrade path to your home Vive, and it's like that's just weird.
So I think
they developed it having consulted with their enterprise customers.
Sure, which makes sense.
Those guys want to be able to walk around the virtual car that they're designing. One to one.
Or they want to have a installation. This is it for destination. I mean, clearly some of the other hardware, like the bigger tracking ranges and things like that, those are for destination. That's for Disney. That's for
And this does support SteamVR 2.0 trackers, which supports a much bigger tracking volume.
Yep.
But they also have a enterprise line. Like if you wanted to buy a Vive, a standard Vive, a couple months ago, and you're running a business, you don't just buy it off the shelf. You can, but you pay more already for support. You pay the enterprise price.
Right.
This isn't that enterprise price. This is still what's going to be MSRP for consumers, which is, to your point, Zach, it's what they're marketing for, the upgrade.
Yeah.
And we talked a little about this in our preview video, but I think it's largely because HTC needs to make money from hardware. They've invested all this money, but they are a hardware company. I know they have their Vive platform and a subscription service for content. They're doing some funding on content right now, but they need people who bought headsets, who are invested in VR in general, to be making these kind of annual upgrades.
Well, we actually didn't mention that it also comes with 6 months of their
Vive port. Yes, 6 months of Vive port is...
Yeah, what does that get you, really?
Right, that there's a monetary equivalent to that, but people are really in it for the headset and using it in Steam VR.
It's a substantial resolution bump. It's not going to turn VR into a window that looks real. You're still going to see the glass, the pixels eventually, the screen door to some extent. But it's also not an unheard of resolution. The Samsung Odyssey Windows Mixed Reality headset has this exact same resolution, and that entire system is $500.
Right, with inside-out tracking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, needs your setup. Yeah. I can't wait to see what the reviews say.
I know the message boards are afire.
People are not happy. I mean, again, they can only drop the price.
Right, this is true.
Yeah.
If it's not selling well...
I don't think the price necessarily needs to impact the reviews. I mean, I think you can still review a product and say whether or not it's... it provides the service that it says it will.
Right.
And whether it's well made. But yes, it also costs this, and it's up to the consumers to decide whether it's worth it to them or not. Judging from our vibe on Reddit, it may not be worth it to a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a personal decision. You know, you have to still make a decision about whether it's worth the money.
An $800 bump. Because again, your old vibe just becomes a doorstop.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I mean, if you're planning on setting up a large tracking area and you have like an extra a laptop, you can have, you know, and if you bought the Vive trackers, right?
You need the new trackers. Which
you need, the new trackers.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the new trackers, the new beacons are not out yet, but the new Vive trackers are out.
Yeah.
So if you bought just the puck that you can add on to an accessory, those were quietly updated to now support this the SteamVR 2.0.
When the lighthouses begins, come
when
out.
When those lighthouses are released.
The new resolution, what is it? 2,880 by 1,600?
Yeah, 2,080. Yeah, 1440 by 1,600 panels. Yeah. They also have a standalone headset, the Vive Focus, and that is just announced to be launching internationally soon. So if you're in China, if you're overseas, you may be able to pick one up. There's no plans to release that in the U.S., so... for the foreseeable future, you know, Santa Cruz is what we have to look forward to for standalone six-off VR. We also have more release dates for content, and GDC is a prime week for new content to be announced and some release dates. We're hoping to see budget cuts soon.
I didn't know they released a release date.
And there is a release date for budget cuts, May 16th.
That's right around the corner.
It is right around the corner.
This is great news.
7 to 8 hours of gameplay, $30 on both SteamVR and Oculus platforms.
Stop it. I don't believe you. Really? That's amazing.
There you go.
This is great. Yeah. I'm super excited about this. This too. Was the killer app, like in the early days.
Yes.
It was the only app for a little while.
It's great. This is great. My son was asking about this game this morning.
Really?
Because it's one of his favorites.
He wants to kill the robots.
He calls it the robot game. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Stealth, action, and puzzle.
Knife throwing. And...
Great portal locomotion mechanic.
They've had a long time to improve it, and I look forward to seeing it today.
I think we're going to get to see it today.
And see what they've changed.
Yeah. Last bits of news. Skyrim VR is out not just for PSVR, but also in Steam and with support for Oculus headsets. And it is now one of the top 10 VR sellers in less than 24 hours of sales.
It's not even out yet. It comes out next month.
It's just the pre-order.
Pre-order.
Yeah, people want to play Skyrim in VR.
This is cool. I look forward to playing this on the desktop as opposed to... PSVR.
Mm. A little bit of sad news in AR. We were able to try Avogant's AR glasses a couple months ago. They had some promising technology.
They're the ones with the volumetric display. Was that them?
No, they're a headset.
They're a headset that had allowed for convergence, so you can focus near and far.
Right.
Away.
Okay.
They just had some layoffs, so I don't know if they were hoping that their technology would be bought, but doesn't seem like they'll be releasing
a
product.
A little bit of a niche. It solves a problem, but it's too small of a problem, I think, for most people.
Yeah. So they have some turnover, new CEO, and good luck to them. Their first product was the Glyph, which is the retinal displays, which I thought was a neat idea, and I wish they had enough to iterate on that. AR, I know there's a lot of money put in AR, and we just need companies to, more than just Magic Leap, to show some promise.
Speaking of money in AR.
Yeah. Magic Leap, did you see this? Magic Leap, they announced a Weta partnership a while ago, and actually Weta just unveiled a new mixed reality stage in New Zealand for production, for content in AR. So they're deeply invested. But Magic Leap also wants developers to be invested. So they launched a preview of their SDK.
Yeah. I got an email and I signed up for their newsletter and got a little announcement a couple days ago or yesterday, whatever it was, and went into their creator portal. And they've got SDK pieces there. They have software you can download for Unity and for Unreal. And...
How are you supposed to develop for it without the hardware?
That's the challenge. There's a lot of information out there, and I know they gave a talk yesterday at GDC that I kind of sort of watched the live stream, or at least people live blogging it. There's a lot of information about kind of the, I don't know, the psychology of developing for AR and for their platform. There's not a lot of details. I mean, there's little things that they've kind of, you know, hinted at as far as, you know, being able to map your environment and be able to track the position of the person and sort of how they're posed. Not a lot of, you know, specifics as far as, you know, update rates and, you know, the abilities and capabilities of the hardware. But there's a lot more of kind of just general, you know, their talks seem to be just kind of like, okay, if you're developing a experience for AR, you know, you don't want to overwhelm the user with information. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to build in sort of, you know, hard animations that are, you know, for instance, if you have somebody, you know, a character jumping off of a flat surface, you want to make it so that, you know, those animations can support different heights because you don't know what the environments are. So a lot of these kind of just general principles of developing applications. But it's kind of a little bit of, you know, hope that, hey, we're actually going to get some, you know, usable content out of this. We'll see. I mean, I think without actual hardware, it's almost impossible to generate anything worthwhile. They do have some simulation stuff, but nothing nothing real.
I forget, do they have a release date?
No.
For Magic Leap?
Nothing yet. Hopefully this year. Yeah.
They say 2018.
Be fun to do an SDK that was done using VR. So if you had a VR headset, you could do some sort of simulation of having a Magic Leap.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that might be that's a solution.
Yeah, do AR in a VR environment.
Yeah, exactly.
We got good news for people who are excited for Santa Cruz, Oculus Santa Cruz. It is, they're demoing some of it behind closed doors at GDC, and Oculus has given out a little bit more information.
Okay.
They think that it has the highest clock rate of any standalone VR device. So I think it's under, so that can obviously change because there's no product yet,
and
right?
And clock rate, what does that even mean?
Sure.
Whatever that clock rate is, it's enough for John Carmack and not enough for everybody else.
Not enough for everybody else.
Right.
We want more than mobile, right? I mean, the Oculus Go has last gen SoC, and
right.
And if Santa Cruz is on that same SoC, whenever it comes out, that's going to be really outdated. So,
or they're just overclocking it.
Right. So hopefully, I know Oculus Go need to be at a fixed price point and it needs to be an entry-level product. Our hope for Santa Cruz is that they're going to, even though it's on a mobile platform, they're going to use some more cutting-edge SoC, even though they're not developing themselves or doing hardware manufacturing themselves, but they're going to partner with some chip manufacturer to give them latest and greatest and also let it run, because SoCs, even on phones, don't always max out their clock rates because of load.
Well, battery
and load.
Heat, all that.
Exactly. So cooling, their cooling solution is going to be important. They say their screen runs at 72 hertz. So,
which it's weird that they didn't go to 90.
Yes.
72.
I know.
It's a weird.
What
yeah.
is that?
But that means it's higher than your 60 hertz of your mobile experiences, which were good enough in many cases. And probably the biggest news, their controllers will have the analog stick.
No.
Yeah.
Wow. Because yes. They went back and forth on that.
Yes. And they had said to us, design was not final, but we thought that was just lip service. But
I think you and I can take full responsibility for that.
There is a new picture of the new controller mold, and you have physical buttons and an analog stick.
Thank you, Oculus.
Yeah. Even though what they're showing at GDC may still have the trackpad. Any guesses for price of Santa Cruz?
Oh, is it? They haven't announced
that. They haven't announced. No. But like, just want to put our.
Oh my goodness!
Put our guesses down. Hopes. For
pricing. I know. I have hopes, but you know, I think it's going to be, you know, sub 400, just because they're.
Whoa!
Oh
okay.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
The Rift is three.
That's what I'm saying. The
right?
Rift is $399, or
no,
it was.
Isn't it $299?
Oh, is it $299?
I have no idea.
It keeps dropping.
It does. It keeps dropping.
But
I think you're right. I think easily a sub four. I wouldn't be surprised if it's less than that.
So $200 for Go,
yeah.
$300 for Rift. Plus, you need a PC. This one has the PC built in.
Yeah, I think it's gonna be $399. That's my. I think it's gonna be sub 400, just barely.
Okay.
Just because it has you know the fastest processor, you know clock speed, you know.
I think
built
it's
gonna
be 600.
You do.
I think it's gonna be 600 and get to 400 eventually through holiday and sales.
yeah, make
I
it
think
up
they're
in
launch
quantity.
It, launch it at a high price point for early adopters.
Yeah, well, if HTC is proving that path.
So Rift is $400.
$399.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, $399. Yes.
So maybe it's the same price. I'm going to say it's the same price. It's Rift. That's what I say.
I hope you guys are right.
What do I know? It doesn't have the sensors, you know? It's just got the inside out.
So but it has a computer.
No. But you're selling an experience.
Yeah, but like a Raspberry Pi is $35.
Yeah, but you're not running VR on a Raspberry Pi. No, even a B+.
Yeah.
Well, I think the bigger hope is that it comes out sooner rather than later.
Right.
And if they're showing some of it at GDC getting developers units to start making content because it's not just the same code
as
what's on the go.
I'm seeing a lot of interesting headlines in our Oculus right now. Social is coming to Oculus Home 2 this summer.
Oh, finally. Was Oculus. They must just be doing their talk right now. That's why.
Yeah. There's wow. Oculus Go uses a static fixed foveated rendering. I don't know what that means. I mean, unless you're just saying that the center gets more attention.
Yes, and that just means that NVIDIA has done this with their graphic cards for a while, which means the parts of the eye that you're not going to focus on.
But they're not doing eye tracking. So unless they're doing eye tracking.
Exactly.
It's not as interesting.
It just means they're optimizing their rendering for the screen.
Looks like we'll have some interesting things to talk about next week.
Absolutely.
Big screen beta got an update with new environments and hyper-realistic lighting. So that's cool.
In your movie
I'm sorry, the 72 hertz for a screen is optional for developers. Most of the content for Santa Cruz will run at 60 hertz, apparently.
I wonder why you would not choose 72.
I think it's, I don't know.
Maybe you're designed
for heat, designed for cooling.
Yeah, sure.
Cooling.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Lots of stuff we're going to talk about next week with regards to GDC.
Post-GDC.
And the content we're going to see. I can't wait. I hope Go is going to be there.
Me too.
Yeah, and I hope they're not going to wait.
We thought we would see that at OC4.
I know. Yeah. I mean, Facebook has their big conference in 2 months.
And there are rumors that maybe that's when Go will be released.
Yep.
But, you know, then there's somebody said that there's going to be a huge announcement at that Facebook event, and it wasn't Go.
Oh.
So, and so something else.
Very exciting times.
Yeah. Oh, and they mentioned AR/VR announcement.
Too much, Jeremy. It's too much.
Can't handle it.
Yeah, it's a lot.
All right, let's go to our final segment of what we've been testing.
Testing this week. Hey, what have you guys been testing?
So Zach, I know you've been testing your new robot.
Yeah.
And any other tools, cool tools you've been using?
Oh, well, I've been using all my tools for my cool robot. A little 3D printing, a little laser cutting, a little milling, all that good stuff. But just kind of getting that going.
All right.
So,
Have I mentioned the Prusa MK3 on this yet? I don't think we do a whole lot of this segment.
No, yeah. So you got a new 3D printer.
I did, yeah.
New toys.
I got myself the Prusa i3 MK3, which was announced the day I finished building my MK2.
So now you have
nerve.
You have two Prusas.
I do. So they offered me a $100 discount.
Oh, great.
I ordered it on Black Friday, so I got a good shipping deal and a free T-shirt.
Nice.
So in addition to my $100 discount.
And you had to assemble it. It was the kit.
I did. Yeah, I did. I like assembling their stuff. And by the way, if you've ever done an earlier printer and then you go to assemble this one, you'll be grateful because they made a lot of great improvements.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Anyway, as far as the printer goes, it is a game changer for me. And it has a lot of improvements, but the killer app is the removable print bed. So it has a magnetic steel sheet. Well, the steel sheet is simply a steel sheet, and the magnets are underneath the heat bed. And you print, and then you lift it off. It just comes right off, and then you flex it, and it's flex steel, so it retains its shape. And the thing, whatever you've printed, pops off.
Wow.
It's just like, pop, here you go. And cooling down the PEI surface already helps with that.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that you can flex it a little bit and it pops right
off. No more scraping.
It's a game changer.
You're not going to ruin that PEI surface.
Exactly.
With
gouging it. I still have my multi-material MK2S, and that has these little things in it from all the hammering and chiseling that I've had to
now,
do.
Now, can you just put one of your plates on the MK2?
Well, no, because there's no magnets to hold it down.
I don't know how you could have fixed the magnets.
No, because I don't
you need to calibrate it. You need to have it rigid.
It's not meant for that. Like the Z leveling and all that, it's all done in firmware. I don't know if the heat elements are close enough to the surface in the same way that they are on the
to
new
transfer
one.
The heat to the metal. Yeah.
So
okay.
The thing I was really interested in is these new stepper motors. That have that
so the silent steppers?
It's not just the stepper motors, it's the controller.
It's the drivers.
Mm. And it's already, like in its normal mode, it's quieter than the stealth mode of the previous model.
Okay.
It's very quiet. But then you put this thing in the stealth mode and it, like your ears stop working. Like it's like, is it on? It's crazy. It's crazy quiet.
Now, what's the trade-off for stealth mode?
It's a little bit slower.
Okay.
But it also, since it's sending less current to the motors, it can't do one of its new features, which is to detect when the motors hit, when your head hits something.
Stall detection.
Yeah. So normally, one of the new features is if the head were to hit a part of the print or something like that, or something that's fallen onto the bed, it would detect that, recenter, and continue printing.
And is that stall detection the same technology that allows it not to need limit switches?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, but that still works. So that's another nice thing of the build is you don't have these leaf switches on the ends of the axes anymore.
It just changes in the voltage when the motors are, and then it just stops.
It's instantaneous. It's not like it hits the edge and tries a few times. It's like magic. And so it's, and it has a filament sensor, so which is not even like an IR beam. It's actually a filament sensor that's the same kind of sensor that's in your optical mouse, so it can watch the filament move through and detect if it's traveling. Mm-hmm. So if the head gets clogged, it will detect that. But this removable print bed, I mean, my God, if this is your first, it really is a game changer.
It's like a heated steering wheel.
Because removing prints from the print bed is the worst part of 3D printing. And this is very highly consistent prints. Like the accuracy.
They look really good.
Sometimes you can't even see the layer lines.
At what resolution?
Just normal, like 0.2.
At 0.2?
You can't see it? Gorgeous. Wow. It's absolutely gorgeous. So I highly recommend this printer.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it, and I'd love to see some prints come out of this. I finished testing the Skydio R1. We should have a review up soon-ish, I think. This is the autonomous drone that has the 13 cameras and can do obstacle avoiding and subject tracking. And it's crazy every time it flies. It's like it's this weird magical device that
robots that chase you.
Yeah, robots that really chase you.
It's like a living visual effect.
Yeah.
It's neat.
And including all the compensation has to do. Like, you can see the physics of its flight because it has to compensate for the momentum, for wind conditions. And so it's not like, a science fiction drone that just can defy gravity. Like, it is still flying. You can still see the rotors and feel the wind. But we can't get to crash, and Gunther was able to take it out on a bike trail and have it follow him through the woods as he's biking down, and the footage looks really cool.
You can get it to get into situations that it can't figure out. So
yes.
It will get stuck, but it won't crash.
It won't crash. It'll just kind of stay there until the battery runs out.
Or until you tell it to land.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I picked up this thing at Target, if you're watching the video. This looks like a tiny old computer monitor.
Or an ATM.
ATM machine.
It's a mobile AR device.
And it's handheld Oregon Trail at Target.
What does it emulate? Does it emulate an actual Commodore or something like that?
I don't know. I want to take this apart and take a look. There are actually a lot of buttons on this thing. Oregon Trail surprisingly needed a lot of, like, there's like yes, no, enter, and D-pad.
It was a computer game, so it assumed you had a keyboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get to type your name in. Up the full Oregon Trail game.
So this has a virtual keyboard on it?
Yeah.
And you use the cursor keys to type?
Yep. Yep. Huh. Yep.
I never played Oregon Trail.
Really?
Everyone played it in school. I never played it.
I was going to say, it's the one game you could play in class on an Apple II back in, when I was that old.
And it was educational.
How long does it take to win?
Oh, that's a long time.
I don't think I ever won.
You play for at least half an hour.
I always died, from hunger.
Yeah.
That was
it's a difficult game.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's, full color screen here, and I thought it was...
What's the refresh rate? Feature.
Good question.
72?
Yeah. Probably much lower. 15, 12. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it looks cool.
Nice
I like
font.
The retro.
This is at Target, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Oregon Trail for today. And we were talking about this earlier. Who is this made for? It's not for kids.
No. This is for nostalgic
adults. Do you think kids
adults.
would like this?
No. I mean, maybe as for a moment.
Yeah.
But this is for me, this is for our generation.
Yeah.
This is tactile buttons, like
which is great. Like people who make stuff notice that because I want a whole store of stuff like this. Just like
it's called Toys R Us.
A new generation. Yeah, it used to be. We were a new generation of people who could buy who wanted video games when we were kids. We are now a new generation of adults who can afford to buy crap like this. So make more crap like that.
Got to fill our shelves with more crap.
I was gonna say.
That's right. And that'll do it for this week's podcast. Thank you out there for listening. Thank you so much, Zach, for stopping by and filling
welcome.
In.
Thanks for having me.
You can find more of Zach's stuff at buildcoolstuff.com.
Yep.
And you've tweeted once or twice too, right?
A whole once or twice. Yeah, I'm not a big Twitter guy, but buildcoolstuff.com if you need to find me.
And we'd love to hear about your future projects next time you're on.
Absolutely.
Jeremy, we have an outro this time?
We do. Justin aka Speed is back with a new one called Pocket Monsters and Wizards.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Whoa. This is a Pokemon gym. It's not a wizard school. Get out of here, you wizards. I'm here catching Pokemon.
What it says on my map.
All right.
See ya.